Welcome back to Cambro Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today is episode 175 of the podcast, and I'm joined by Paul Richardson. I could list Paul's extensive bio and huge list of achievements, but that would take up a lot of your valuable listening time before we dive into this episode. However, you may well know Paul from his time as executive director and chairman of Gymshark, the previous joint owner of All Saints, and the current owner of Hera. Expect to learn about Paul's genesis story and the upbringing, family environment, and exposure to business from a young age that shaped the man that we get to speak to today. You'll hear numerous sliding doors moments where big decisions led to the path that Paul has been able to walk. You'll also learn about various businesses that Paul's built, scaled, bought, and sold during his career, and the various lessons that he's taken on board and implemented off the back of that. You may or may not be aware just how much of an impact Paul had as the businessman that Ben Francis and Lewis Morgan turned to at the gym at David Lloyd to help them grow Gymshark from 4.5 million to over 1 billion pounds. Within this episode, I also speak to Paul about his purchase of Hera, as well as his affinity with Birmingham City Football Club, his previous involvement on the board there in the early 2000s, and his recent takeover bids alongside Maxi Lopez. I loved having this conversation with Paul, and I know you're going to enjoy it as well. And we could have delved into so much more beyond what we got into, but I'm very appreciative of Paul's business mind and the lessons that we're able to share with you during this full hour discussion. If you've enjoyed it, please do share it with a friend who would also enjoy this episode. In the show notes, Paul highlights his Instagram to get in touch with him at the end of this episode, but I've also included his LinkedIn if you want to connect with him there. Today's podcast is sponsored and supported by Vibe. Vibe is an international nutrition company with operations in Australia, New Zealand, across the UK and Europe. Vibe was founded by two Scottish entrepreneurs, and given this episode is all about entrepreneurism and business, it's quite fitting that it is sponsored by an entrepreneurial business like Vibe. Vibe was started out in Australia by Gordon and Rory, but they've since brought it back to the UK in the last 6 months. Many of you will have seen me share Vibe on my Instagram story when I'm having a quick and easy breakfast at my laptop before starting work. And that quick and easy breakfast is Vibe's cornerstone product, which is a nutritionally complete meal shake with 29 grams of protein, 26 vitamins and minerals, complex carbs, essential fats, and some added premium ingredients. Now, this is where it got interesting for me too, versus other shakes that are available. Vibe includes probiotics and nootropics, which promote both a healthy brain and a healthy gut. And this is Vibe's key point of interest for me, because I'm always looking to pursue peak performance. And like me, I know that you're a busy individual as well, where whether you're building a side hustle like me with the podcast and progressing your corporate career, if you're stretched for time, you cannot afford to sacrifice your nutrition as well. And Vibe provides me with all the nutrition that I need to set me up for the day and keep me full until lunchtime. From as little as just £1.50 per meal, it's a bit of a no-brainer to give them a try. The link to buy Vibe will be in the show notes, www.vibe.com or www.vibe.eu or AU, depending where you are across the world. And you can use the code CAMBRO to get 15% off. Before we dive into this episode, it's been incredible to feel the support from you guys on Instagram and over my email list and even on LinkedIn for hitting the top 1% of all podcasts in the world, which feels a little bit surreal to still verbalize that. So thank you massively for all your support. If you are new here, hit the subscribe or the follow button, and I promise not to let you down. Next Sunday, we also have a heavily requested pair of guests in the Stallman Brothers, so I'm excited to bring that to you, as well as this fantastic conversation with Mr. Paul Richardson right now. Paul, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
And when I say I'm excited for this one, there's certainly been a build-up towards it because you're such a busy man. So very pleased to manage to snag an hour in your diary. And people will understand quite how busy you are when we talk about all the things that you've been up to and you're still up to at this moment in time. But I want to take a step back and I want to understand a bit more around how we ended up with the Paul Richardson that we've got in front of us today, and talk about your upbringing, how you grew up, and how that shaped you.
Yeah, fine. I mean, nothing's off limits. So, some of it's been heard before. So we'll try and sort of move around to different things, which will be good fun.
Yeah, of course. So where did you grow up, Paul?
I was originally born right in Birmingham. And so the sort of story starts with my mom meet my dad. My dad was a market trader, a bit of a lad. She got pregnant, and that was way back in sort of 1959 when I was born. And I was due to be born at an orphanage and to be given away. But when I was born, she decided she wanted to keep me. So that was the sort of real early beginnings of the sort of, I suppose, like the sliding doors moments of, you know, if I had been, you know, been given into the orphanage and, you know, where would you be? What would you be doing? It fascinates me.
Yeah, of course. There's so many different considerations because, like you say, everything that's happened previously leads to where we are now. Of course, there's always little different paths that you could take at different points, but you sometimes wonder what might have happened off the back of that. And you said your dad was a market trader. I've heard you speak about him as a bit of a wheeler dealer. Del boy would maybe be a harsh term, but he did lots of different things at that point in time. How much were you learning at a young age from him from a business perspective, I guess, given what you've gone on to do now?
A hell of a lot, to be honest. I mean, again, he was you know, a fairly sort of simple man. And in terms of his outlook, he was a hard worker, which is, you know, probably where I've got, you know, that from. But also he was a bit of a character and a bit of a lad. And but yeah, I always learned things like always having a plan B. He called it, it's a really old fashioned term, you know, like a card thing, of having the ace in the hole, always having something in your back pocket type of scenario. So that's always sort of fared well with me. You know, you're always trying to think ahead, and I'm a big believer in thinking of what the other side is doing, you know, in terms of when you're sort of if you're trying to do a deal or you're trying to get a transaction done or a contract or whatever it might be, you know, you've always got to think what the other side's doing.
Yeah, undoubtedly. And I guess even at that particular level, you can scale that to some of the things that you've been up to over your career as well. But I wonder, was there any indications during your childhood and some of the things that you were doing as a young man that would have indicated that you would go on to own so many different businesses, to advise so many different businesses? Like, what was there any indication of what was to come?
Yeah, I mean, I was always, I love work. You know, that was my thing. I loved going with my dad working and his mates and, you know, just going out and doing things. Always loved doing that. My mum and dad had like the old-fashioned coffee house type, you know, bacon and eggs, you know, that sort of thing, you know, not the sort of posh ones there are today, like your Costa and stuff like that. And I was always working in there, always buzzing around in there. So that was it, you know, the work was a very important early part of my life. Very important.
What kind of businesses did your dad own then? You've mentioned the cafe. I understand he had a grocery store as well. What other kind of things was he doing?
Yeah, he was a Del boy. So he'd be into sort of anything, you know, scrap metal, you know, buying and selling. I mean, I think I've mentioned in a couple of podcasts before, you know, he got involved with a few things he shouldn't have done and went to prison a few times. You know, he wasn't, I just say he wasn't a very good criminal. That's what I sort of put it down to. He always got caught by the sounds of it. But yeah, he was into anything where he could make some money, you know, to put money on the table, to, you know, to provide food for the family. I've got three siblings, brother and two sisters, all younger. So yeah, he always did that, which was really good.
Yeah, undoubtedly. And I understand the first kind of business that really went somewhere was the waste business, which was the family business at the time, and that's what you started to get involved in. What was it like working with your dad, almost not on an equal footing, but as a more important person in the business than maybe somebody that was like serving in the cafe on the weekend when it was when you were a teenager?
Yeah, I mean, I used to have transport jobs originally. You know, we'd deliver things to... He worked out that, and this is way back, you know, it's not really, you know, Amazon and all that sort of thing, but he worked out that people needed things sometimes really quickly. So we would deliver a sort of, or he would deliver like a small box all the way down to, a boat yard on the coast, because the boats couldn't sail without this small part being fixed to it or something like that. So, and he used to call that, it's called panic transport. So it was, his nickname then was Tommy Panic, because everything was, you know, you've got to go now. So, you know, you need to do this now. We need this important thing now. So we used to sort of do that really with him. And I used to sit there for hours driving, you know, he'd be driving and I'd be reading the map and things like that, because then they just didn't have sat navs, So it wasn't quite horse and cart, but you had a map and you used to write it all down and things like that, and you'd be reading it out where to go. So that was the very early days, you know, and then got into the waste business, which, you know, was in those days you couldn't drive a truck until you're 21. So, you know, I would be on the mechanic, probably a mechanic at that point, so fixing trucks and things like that, so and big diggers and that sort of thing.
How did that start to scale then?
It really came to a head when I was 19, and we've got several trucks. I think we've got about six or seven or whatever, all old, constantly breaking down. But my dad was only, he didn't really like debt. You know, he came from absolutely less than nothing. And he sort of scrambled his way through, clawed his way through. But he didn't like debt, so everything had to be cash and paid for, you know. He didn't want any hire purchase, it was in them days. There wasn't all the fancy different things you could do now, leasing and all those things. So we got to about 19 and I realised that, you know, it was just such hard work. It was constantly breaking down, you know, we were giving a bad service all the time. We've got to skip our business by this time, by the way. And I sort of said, well, we should buy newer trucks and we should, you know, push on with that and it would be better and this, that, really. He wouldn't do it. So I left. I left when I was 19. And then I eventually, I was constantly talking to him. We fell out, but then we sort of made up and whatever, you know, he was disappointed, but so was I. And eventually he said one day, do you want to come back? And I said, yeah, I do, 100%, but we've got to do this. And that was to buy two new trucks and some new containers and invest some money in some infrastructure. And he said, okay, which was amazing. And from there was that we gave a much better service. The trucks never broke down. Instead of having six trucks, we had four trucks. Instead of having six drivers, we only had four drivers. And instead of doing, you know, the truck doing five skips a day, we were doing 10 skips a day. So the whole thing just changed, the dynamic of it just completely changed into a business that was, you know, better prepared, making more money, you know, and the service was great. So the service, you know, the business expanded rapidly.
It seems like that's the first indication for me from your story, Paul, where it indicates that kind of change management piece, which you're now so well known for in terms of going in and looking at a business and saying, this is how we could do things better. Let's move forward in this direction.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That actually was, you know, it was, and then we just carried on from there where we kept replicating that sort of model. And then we became the largest skip hire company in Birmingham. And then we became the largest skip hire company in the West Midlands and then to the Midlands. And we also went into waste management and recycling at the same time. So we went from a skip company, which that's, you know, there was loads of them around, you know, but we went to be the best skip company. But then we also moved into waste management, which all the large companies were. You know, Biffa was still around then. That's some people recognize now. They're still around. But they were a waste management company, not a skip hire company. And we became both, which was unheard of.
Yeah, and I guess that just shows again the business acumen to recognize if we can do both and be like a one-stop shop for maybe your customer base, then it makes it a much more sticky, your contract. So maybe they won't leave you for the skip hire because you're doing the other element of side of things.
That's exactly what it was, but there was also another angle. In those days, if you wanted to carry on building the business, it would be a lifestyle business. If you wanted to make some serious money, you know, an actual lump of money, you had to sell it. And the only way to sell it was to become partly a waste management and recycling company rather than a skip hire. They didn't, the big companies like Biffa and those sort of guys didn't want to buy a skip hire company. They wanted something that was already doing what they were doing. So you entered their market, you became a threat, you were better at it than they were because they were lazy and thought that no one else could get into it. Consequently, they wanted to buy you, and that was what we did.
Yeah, it grew to a really good extent. And was it 1988 that you sold the business with you and your dad?
1989. Okay. Before you were born, I think, probably. I'm not sure, but I think so.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, that was the first sale. My dad was in his late 50s at the time. And he thought it was the right time. His health wasn't that good. He passed about a year after that, but it was the right time for anyone. I was just under 30. He was just under 60. So yeah, it was a good time to get some money in for him to be settled. And I was just under 30, so I didn't really care that much. It was nice, but I was thought, well, I'm indestructible, and I can just carry on.
29, dad's not in the best of health, but you've got that appetite to just go again. What was next? Because I appreciate when you sell a business like that, there'll be all sorts of covenants and agreements that mean that you have to perhaps adhere to certain conditions for a period of time.
Yeah, so that was, I was about 29 when we sold the business. So, and as I said, my dad wasn't very well. He passed about a year afterwards. The company we sold to was the second largest in the world, and it was American, and they sold me this American dream. You know, they were going to make me a director, I was going to be this, I was going to be that. It didn't turn out like that. I mean, it was just a big American machine that came over to the UK and wanted to do it their way. And even though I'd built a successful business and everything, it was like, yeah, you just got to, you know, adhere to the rules. So I got a 3-year covenant. I did 21 months and then I couldn't take it anymore. So I left, called it a 21 month sentence, but they did several things really, really well. And two of them were, they were into accounting, you know, it was financials every month and, you know, every mid month and things like that, which I'd never really done before. You know, everything was just, yeah, just keep going. And then we'll get the, you know, we'll see if we make money at the end of the year. And they did all their stats. So they knew everything about how many minutes it took to deliver a skiff, how many tip or weights and everything. So what I did was I took all of that, learned everything about it, took all their models, and then I started again after I'd left and started another waste company up. But I incorporated day one all of that sort of information. So it meant that I got the sort of the best new waste company that was going, because it was, you know, entrepreneurial. It was, you know, we were so agile and everything, but also we were really professional and we knew everything that was going on, which was far better than any smaller waste company. So, and then we could grow it really, really quickly, which is what I did again.
Seriously strong foundations and all the different systems in place with that deadly ability to, like you say, be entrepreneurial, be agile, to outmaneuver these big boys that were maybe a little bit too bound by the red tape, whereas you had the infrastructure, but you also had the ability to just go after and get the deals that you needed to get initially.
Yeah, they were good at buying companies. They weren't very good at integrating it. They just weren't very good at building, and that's what we were good at. So again, we just flew. I mean, you know, we just launched again in 1992. So I sold in 89, launched again in 92, and then we're off again. And, you know, we just went, yeah, crazy again. But I was on my own then because my dad had passed and he'd gone. And even towards the end of the previous waste business, you know, he wasn't really doing anything. You know, he'd sort of stepped well back by then.
Given that, yeah, a lot of the listeners will know you really strongly, Paul, from some of the more modern brands that you've been acquainted with recently, and even the t-shirt that you're wearing, Hera. What was so attractive about going back into waste management again? I guess it was what you knew at that point in time, but you obviously doubled down and went forward with it again.
Yeah, I mean, when I sold in 89 and then went back in 92, there was still an opportunity. So I initially thought that these big guys from across, you know, from America, and there was some from France and Spain, would come in and just take it over. But then I realized actually that they weren't as good as we were. You know, the guys in the waste game at a lower level, you know, we had a lot to offer, especially myself. And I think that with my thought process around taking what I thought they did good and what we did good, I just thought we could beat them. And we did. So again, you know, it was just assessing the opposition, and these big boys, yeah, they must know what they're doing, but actually a lot of them don't. And you've got to look at what they do well, but look at what they don't do well, and then you can take advantage, you know. So, and I've used that throughout whatever I've done, to be fair.
Yeah, I think you can see that you benefited from that short 21-month sentence you described it as with that larger business, and then you applied that relentlessly in a space where you could bring your skill set and your traits as well. And I know waste management in particular is a very low margin business, in that it can be very difficult to be profitable. It can be quite easy to get high turnover because the contracts are of a great size, but the margins are very, very tight. How did you manage to maximize that, to build these profitable businesses rather than just behemoths of turnover?
Yeah, again, in that day and age, waste management businesses were sold by turnover. So again, as long as you could make money, even if it was, as you rightly just said there, a very small margin. If you could make a small margin, that was like making 20, 30% EBITDA in today's businesses. So, you know, a couple of percent was doing, you're doing really, really well. But, you know, you had a good, strong business there with good, strong foundations along the way. So again, for my mind, it was, okay, what can I build this up to? And I'm, you know, it's on a growth pattern that was, you know, really, really fast. But again, I'd already got the foundations. I knew what I was doing. It was like the second time around. It was, okay, I won't make mistakes that I made before, or not as many of them, and push it on really quickly. But yeah, it is a low margin business. It is capital intensive. It's all the things that I wouldn't probably do again now if I could really help it. Because again, I'm in a different frame of mind, and you know, I've found different ways of doing things.
When did you diversify away from waste management for the first time then?
I sold again in 2000, and the reason there was, again, it was a good time for selling at that point in time. You know, the big boys that had their cycle again, where they sort of wanted to come back in and buy businesses, so that they were on the hunt for really, really good businesses. And I was at a point in my life, I was a little bit sort of fed up with having one business and all my eggs in one basket. So I had this sort of thought process around having several companies doing different things and spreading the sort of load a little bit. So I wanted a group company and to do different things. And I immediately bought a chemical sort of disposal company. Incorporated in there was another company that took down, that demolished forecourts, petrol forecourts at that point, because there was lots of petrol stations and they were sort of joining together and not having, they were bigger and there was lots of small ones. So there was loads to sort of dismantle. So we did that. I was repairing and doing some of the trucks as well. So they were sort of related, but they weren't all the same. And at that point then, just a couple of years after that, was when I joined Birmingham City Football Club. Around about that time as well, thereabouts, I bought All Saints. So that was my first sort of foray into retail of any description, which was completely off what I'd ever done before.
I was going to say, very different to everything you've done before, but of course there would have been that wealth of experience that you brought to the board there, both in the football sense, but also for All Saints as well. What brought about your involvement in Birmingham City Football Club for the first time then? Like, who got you involved?
So there's a guy there who was the commercial manager, a guy called Simon Bradley, who's passed away since. And I was just a supporter. I did all the waste from the club and I had a box and all that sort of stuff and got on well with everyone. And I'd not long sold my waste company. And apparently David Sullivan was getting a bit fed up with the club and wanted to dispose of it. At that point in time, he wanted 20 million for the whole lot, but there was no one around to spend 20 million. It wasn't a fashionable thing. So he decided to sell 5% slots. They asked Simon, or Karen Brady asked Simon, who had got that sort of money around in the Midlands, and he was a Blues fan, and my name came up and one other guy. So they made contact with me, and initially it was, 5% for £1 million, and it was like, not a chance. But then Karen said, well, let's have lunch and we'll talk it through. So we had some lunch and said, oh, you're not interested. I said, no. She said, well, what would you pay for it? I said, well, I'm not really sure. So sort of went away and I called her back and said, well, I'll give you this much money. She said, okay, let me think about it. And she said, come back, we'll have another lunch again. So I went into the ground actually and we had lunch at the ground and all the guys were there. And she came back and said, well, we can't accept that. And I said, okay, what about this? And she said, she went away and came back and said, yeah, great, okay, we'll accept it. And it wasn't a lot of money at the time. It was £100,000 at that point in time. But she said, look, we don't want you to go onto the football club board. We'd like you to come onto the PLC board. So that was it. I was on. I was, you know, it was my dream job, in a sense, to be invested in a football club that I love, and to be part of it with David Sullivan, David Gold and Karen, who, you know, were really good operators, you know, really good.
And the football club had a bit of success in that period of time, ended up in the Premier League, Paul. What role did you play in that?
Not much. I think probably the lucky mascot. We hadn't been in the Prem, or it was called the Prem then, but the top division for 16 years. And I was there 6 months, and we got into the playoffs and we went up. But it wasn't much to do with me. It was just, I think all the all the stars were aligned to take us up.
What were the main things that you saw within the football club for that first time that you were involved that you maybe thought, right, we can do this better, or we can do this on an improved level?
It was connecting with the locals on the right level. So again, David Sullivan and David Gold were sort of, in essence, London pawn barons at the time, and it wasn't their club, but they did an amazing, amazing job for Birmingham City. But they couldn't connect with the locals, and that's what I did. It was, giving them credibility that, Paul Richardson's involved, then let's talk to them. And, there was different deals that we did over the time of that first 6 months that was quite difficult. When we went on to the Prem, it was literally easy, because it was the first time we'd been in the Prem for ages. There was Villa were in the Prem at the time, so there was only one choice in the city. Because there are fans who will only go almost to see the other side, so to see Man United, to see Arsenal, Chelsea. It creates a different atmosphere rather than be a diehard Blues or Villa fan. There are lots of sort of corporate partners who want that. So we became the other choice in the city at that point.
And also to advertise with, to be on the boardings, to be on the shirt, to be on the shorts, to be on the training gear. If you know that it's got X number of million eyes via Sky, or that if you're playing United, however many people are going to tune in, it's so much. As a commercial man, you must have been like, right, this is a real game changer, in the same way that if a team gets into Europe or gets into the Champions League, like they get radically more eyes on their sponsors.
Yeah, that's right. So that's what sort of made it easier, to be able to talk to people, because they wanted to talk to you. They wanted to come to the club. The attendances went up, I think we're at about 30,000, and it was, it was almost always 30,000 full, which was great news for the club itself and everything else and just the profile. So yeah, it wasn't me that took the penalty that took us up. It was Darren Carter. So I do remember it well, because I was there.
Yeah, amazing, Paul. And we'll pop a pin in Birmingham City Football Club for a little bit, and we'll definitely get back to that, because it's certainly a hot topic for you and what your future holds. But I want to understand, how did you first get involved with Gymshark, which of course are a Birmingham business born and bred?
It's pretty sort of well documented. It was David Lloyd Gym in Bromsgrove. I lived locally to there. That was my gym that I went to. But it was also the gym that Ben Francis, Lewis Morgan, and all their mate, their little sort of crew of mates went to, Dan Crane and a few other guys, Craig Olsop, all the guys who went there with all their mates, they went there too, and that's where I met them. And they were the guys just asking me questions, because, Lewis and Ben, to be fair, didn't have anyone really to talk to at that time. They'd got a business, it was doing really well, but didn't really have any business background or know much about business, and neither did their mom and dad or their brothers or sisters.
So you were the kind of mentor figure that they could ask questions in the gym when they were having their chess session, and they were like, that's that Paul Richardson, the business guy, I'll pick his brain.
Yeah, that's what they did call me, the business guy. So yeah, it was just, they kept coming up asking different questions, and we talked earlier about that sliding doors moment. I could have sort of gone, well, I don't answer their questions, just a few young guys. But for some reason, I liked them. They were interesting guys. And, there was a different energy. There was Ben, who was the quiet one. And then there was Lewis, who was the loud one. And so they sort of bounced off each other. And, it was just one of them things. I can't tell you why I sort of spoke to them and answered their questions. I think, I do like helping people. And I think that's carried on through, till today. I still help quite a lot of people, because you never know what's going to come for it. You can't help everyone, but it was an interesting dynamic at the time.
You obviously trained from a bodybuilding perspective, a strength training perspective for years. I know you've even competed as well. I guess the fact that they were producing something that was quite radical at that period in time in terms of the aesthetic of the clothing may have like caught your attention too, because I remember when I first started training, the clothing was very much the big baggy joggers, the kind of Kai Greene look if we were to pick somebody from an aesthetic, whereas everything they did was like the fitted stuff. Like I remember seeing on YouTube when it was like Jeff Said, Alan Gabby, Matt August wearing the Lux tracksuit and thinking, this looks so different to anything I've ever seen in the gym before. And it looked, and the key word was like aesthetic. And you were like, okay, this is interesting.
Yeah, and that's what they did. One thing I sort of talk about quite a lot is most ideas, very, very few original ideas in this world, you know, absolutely, utterly original. You know, you look at Uber. It's not original, it's a cab. It's gone from a cab that did X to a cab that does XX now. You know, and it's a more modern, you know, sort of app and everything else. You know, it's all just tweaked up, you know, turned all the dials. And really that's what they did. You know, they took the tracksuit, but they wanted something different. You know, they wanted the aesthetic look. So they did it, you know, they cut them, they sewed them, they did them, they modeled them, they did everything else. So yeah, it was radical. It was, you know, at that time, you know, as you rightly say, Kai Green, you know, Jay Cutler and all those guys were so big. They were wearing all these big tracksuits. So the guys didn't want that. And, you know, the guys who said there, Jeff and Ogus and all them, were sort of the models for Ben and Lewis to look at. And that's what they did. You know, they wanted it. They were the customer. You know, Ben and Lewis and their mates were the customer, so they could make it for themselves and know that other guys would want that.
That's true. They were literally selling to the same demographic, whereas a lot of businesses sometimes are selling to a very set demographic that they've like identified, whereas these guys were actually their own customer base.
Yeah, and that can be really, really important. And if you look at some of the fashion brands that are around, you know, they are the brand, you know, they're selling to themselves in a sense, you know, George and Michael that represent, you know, they are that customer, you know, I can't think of the other one, Sisters, I can't think of the whole name, but they're the same, they are the customer, you know, etc. So a lot of the guys or girls are the customer and do it for themselves, and then it takes off. And you rightly said there, it's actually slightly more difficult when you aren't that customer exactly. You've then got to work out what they want. So again, that's a different way of doing it. But you know, we all can't be our own customers.
Undoubtedly. When did the kind of informal chats and advice in David Lloyd become something more formal?
The turning point was to do with a big stock order that they had got delayed, and Ben came to me and he looked quite ill, to be fair, and he just said, you know, we've been delayed, they got orders they wanted to fulfill and couldn't do it. And you know, I said to him, look, you know, I made a couple of phone calls, I've got a friend who had got some suppliers in Turkey or somewhere like that, and you know, they used to put them on a truck, so it was generally quicker. So I sort of introduced them to that, and they came to my office and had meetings and looking around that. So it was around there. It went from sort of just in essence having chats to actually helping them with something sort of on a physical nature. And that at that meeting, that's the meeting we met Steve Hewitt as well. So, you know, it was a real sort of pivotal moment in Gymshark history, because Steve was on the friend of mine, that he was his advisor. So I was Ben and Lewis's advisor and he was their advisor. And then we got together and it sort of went from there. But and then I became a sort of consultant doing one day a month and went to one day a week. And Steve joined doing, I think, you know, one day a week and then 2 days, and he just went from there.
Steve's background was Reebok, wasn't it? Because he was very much involved in moving Reebok towards that whole CrossFit scene, which it's now synonymous with. Was it instantly a case of we need to get Steve involved? Like, what prompted you to introduce him to the business?
Yeah, so, I mean, again, Steve went to David Lloyd at Bromsgrove Gym, and I'd seen him to sort of nod to, but I didn't know who he was. He would just be working there. and he was sort of in between, he left the sort of Reebok scene and he was doing something else. But I think he was using the gym now and again to train and then obviously, you know, do some work, which a lot of people do. Out of that meeting, I sort of said to Steve, "What, can you hang back?" And I sort of then got to know him at that meeting. And, you know, when he mentioned Reebok and all the stuff he'd done and blah, blah, I then just called the guys and said, "Guys, you know, we need to speak to Steve. You know, he's available. We need to get him on your team." And basically, almost, you know, after a bit of consultancy work, just came straight in as MD and just went straight to that point because he was far more experienced than anyone else.
What were the big things that you needed to do at Gymshark to move it from this exciting young idea where, albeit they'd seen some initial success, some huge Black Fridays, some huge expos like Body Power, and the brand was front of mind, but how do you turn it into what it's grown to become now, this billion-dollar company?
Foundations. I mean, simple as, you know, it was like, and I think this is one of Steve's famous sayings, you know, they'd got the house, but they were building an extension, a swimming pool, a gym, and everything else, but there was no foundations there. So, you know, this house was going to come crumbling down at some point. They were putting four stories on it, you know, they were putting a patio on it, but, you know, everything was going on there, but there was no foundations. So, you know, they hadn't really got any stock control. They had, I don't even think they got insurance. Their accountant was completely useless. You know, they didn't produce financials. It was like going into, I suppose, you know, just, you know, some teenagers' sort of common room at school type thing, you know, where it's just great fun. You know, they're having great fun doing everything, earning money, you know, both driving Audi R8s, you know, doing great things for young guys, you know, why not? But the likelihood is it would have come crashing down at some point because, you know, anything without foundations will come crashing down. So immediately it was, Steve and I are big into it, is put the foundations in play. And then you can start building from there. So the trouble is the house has already been built, so we probably have to underpin it a bit here and there, you know, using a building term.
It was already of a good size, like you said, it was a good couple of million it was turning over. So the fact that it had got to that stage without having such solid foundations is quite remarkable. And it's now in a position where you obviously came in and you and Steve provided this hardened experience that just were like, right, okay, let's really build this in a position where it can go to what its potential should allow it to, but only if we do these basics correctly. And of course, beyond that, it starts to become less basic and becomes more of the clever things that you did, like some of the huge projects like the Gymshark HQ, for example. Is like, that's like a legacy that's going to be there forever associated with that brand.
Yeah, I mean, and things like that are still, you know, building HQ was, again, going from Bromsgrove, which was, we couldn't even have meetings at Bromsgrove back in the day. You know, they had to come to my office, which was my sort of no-waste office over in the other side of Bromsgrove. And then we had some porter cabins for them. And then from porter cabins, we went to Redditch, which was the first proper office. And then, you know, the Redditch was about 11,000 square feet. And then, you know, HQ, GSHQ, was 42,000 square feet. So you've got to have real good faith that you're going to make it. But when I took on HQ, it was 42,000 square feet, but it was in four wings. So there was two on the ground floor, two on the top floor. So when I sold it to them, you know, I remember walking up to it and you've got three different people. So you've got Steve, who's quite conservative. You got Ben, who is really out there in terms of, if you want something, that's it, it's done. You know, and then there's myself, where I'm sort of in between, but I'm more leaning towards Ben and taking chances, because I'm probably, out of the three of them, I'm probably the one who's most entrepreneurial because of my background. But yeah, Ben says, I want this place. We walked up to it and I said, yeah, no problem, we'll get it. But it was always in my mind that if it went wrong for us, we've got four wings, so that we could rent out three of the wings or two of the wings to someone else if we have to.
That's the ace in the hole that your dad told you about.
That's it. That's the one. Yeah.
There we go. I love synergy. It's interesting that there was three of you at that point. Lewis, Morgan had exited the business by that point. How did that change the dynamic when you went from four decision makers to three?
It was much, much better, because at some times during the, when there was four of us, it was two against two, in a sense. There was the two older guys and the two younger guys and blah, blah, blah. So that was a tough dynamic. And, you know, Lewis wanted to do other things, and, you know, he was willingly moved out of the business in sort of two phases over the time. When it became three, it's the perfect scenario. And I have that with my daughters at the moment with Hera, because you've always come out of that room with a decision, because two of you have got to be right. And all you have to do is basically know that whatever the decision, it's the best decision, and the best decision always wins. And then you just come out, you don't have any sort of, regret on it or anything, or carry on. The decision's made, okay, we're done, we'll move on, and we all go in the right direction. But you make the decision, and that's really good for a smaller business. And for a larger business, to be fair, you can get decisions made.
I think sometimes people say three's a crowd, but I certainly think that from the way that you've described it, you actually always ensure that you have a majority, because it might be that sometimes you go in and all three of you agree on something, but when two are against one, the one just has to accept that these two people who they completely trust, completely have faith in, have decided that this is the way that we're going to go in. So there's a kind of, you shut the door on that particular argument, and it doesn't become something that comes on and on and on and lingers.
Yeah, and when you've got two and two, or, you know, three and three, then that can linger, because I think it's more likely to. When there's three, you just go, well, okay, maybe I lost this one in a sense, but I didn't lose it. That's probably a wrong word, but, it's 2-1 on that one. It could be 2-1 on the other way next time. It makes no difference. You just know that the decision gets made and you move on, and you want to be able to move quickly in business if you need to be agile. So, Gymshark in particular, or, we'll be, in essence, likened to Nike and Adi and people like that, who will be this great big machine trying to turn. And obviously Gymshark in its day, when it was 4 million to 12 to 40 to 100, will be a different machine to what it is now at 500, But that's the same with any company. It doesn't matter who you are or what you do. There are different levels as you move forward, and you have to accept it. So if you can't move a 500 million like you can move a 5 million, it just doesn't happen.
Of course. You become slightly less agile because there's more things that you need to tick off.
Absolutely. But just don't get bogged down by it. Again, if you can, for my mind, you can divide it up a little bit and have, say, let's say you could have five companies doing, in essence, five inside sort of divisions doing 100 a piece in a sense, and just make it more agile internally rather than one big ship.
Again, that's kind of business wisdom from years and years of experience, Paul, because that if you can divide those down, they almost run like little individual entrepreneurs running each department, which gives you that agility.
Yeah, and again, as long as you can respect the decisions of other people and work with them, and then basically, as you said, you can have in essence five smaller sort of operations, but again, they've all got to come together to be going the same direction. So you can't sort of have them here and one going off this way and one going off that way. Your job then as that leader of that sort of pack of five need to be able to bring them together and keep them going in the best direction possible for the business.
Yeah, on a less serious note, I know that you're blue and a lot of the Gymshark guys were Villa fans. Was there ever any office banter on that?
Ben's a diehard Villa fan, So, we had a lot of different chats. But, he used to go to the Villa, I think, with his granddad. And so, Steve's a Newcastle fan. So, yeah, that was... but again, Newcastle are up there now, and it comes and goes all the time. So I don't know when Blues are going to be up there, but I can live in hope.
Well, good ownership does an awful lot of things, Paul, and I'm sure we'll touch on that in just a moment's time. But you also mentioned that you and your daughters are now involved at Hera, and you now own that business. Why Hera? Like, what was it that prompted you to get involved there?
My daughters both did fashion degrees. Georgia went off. Georgia's the youngest one. She went off into PR and worked in London in various PR companies, Carlotta, etc. Holly stayed more on the fashion front. In fact, she did work for Gymshark at one point for a couple of years. She was asked to work there by Ben and Lewis, so it wasn't me. She also worked for MyProtein, and also worked for Hera as well for 12 months. So she was involved in different companies doing sort of, you know, fashion and obviously sportswear and gym wear and stuff. But I always wanted to work with them. You know, we've had this sort of little bit of a dream for ages. And, you know, Hera, I was offered at Gymshark back in 2018. We didn't do the deal then. And then he came back. And, yeah, I've always liked the brand to look at. I know it's a strong brand. You know, there were some issues with it. But I like the challenge, you know. And we had a choice. We could either do a brand from zero or I could buy a brand. And, you know, the opportunity came for me to buy that brand. And in essence, although it was a damaged brand at the time, it meant we could get onto a move. I always called it a moving bus. You know, we could jump on the bus rather than be waiting at the bus stop.
That's really interesting because, like you say, you'd seen behind the scenes of the business, probably in the most minute detail in 2018 when Gymshark were looking at it. So when it came a few years down the line, and it probably hadn't had a great pandemic by any stretch of the imagination. But this time round, you were like, right, I do know that this business can work. And I suppose you probably had some plans for it in 2018 that you're now able to do because you're in charge.
Yeah, I mean, I would have liked us in 2018 to buy it, you know, because again, I think from Gymshark's point of view, one thing I would have liked to have happened for us to diversify into a few other businesses, you know, but it was always that we were too busy with every, you know, the business itself and the core business. So, and I totally agree that we, you know, you shouldn't sort of digress from something that's really, really good and then get sidetracked into doing other things. But I think, you know, from my point of view, I would have probably liked that for us to diversify, but understand why we didn't. So seeing the business in 2018, coming back in 2021 when Ash came back to me, was I knew the business had suffered, I knew what it suffered by, I knew how. So it wasn't like he was hoodwinking me in any way, shape or form. I knew it was in bad shape. And, you know, that meant that, you know, I bought it at a different price and with some legacy.
It was probably more wounded, Paul, than fatally damaged. It was just like it had gone through a few scrapes.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was a wounded animal in the corner that, you know, you needed to give some care and attention to and a bit of medicine and, you know. Sort of just gave us a great start.
Yeah, absolutely. And the goal was to grow Hera to 100 million. You've come out and said that publicly. What are the big things that need to happen for you to achieve that?
It'll take us a while. That's no easy job to do. But I think it's capable of that. You know, I know some of the other businesses around. I know what they're doing. I think for us, UAE and everywhere else in between, you know, I think it's a good market. Over to the east again, knowing what Gymshark did with the way they therefore get decent growth.
Yeah, that's extremely exciting, and I find it quite funny that again you've gone full circle where you worked with your dad and now you work with your daughters. Was that something that was always front of mind? I know you said you've always said to your daughters, "Oh, we'll have a business together one day." But like, how realistic was that as you were balancing all the different businesses that you've built over the years? Was this just the one that this can work together because of the different skill sets that all combine now?
I would sacrifice all my other businesses to just do the one with my daughters, to be fair. That was the one we wanted. It was just finding the right one that they really, I mean, it was up to them, you know. I mean, I wasn't just going to buy the business because, you know, I wanted it in a sense. So it's like, okay, this is available. What do you think? Holly'd already worked there, so she knew that it was inside out as well. She knew, you know, more than I did in terms of the detail. But yeah, it's always what we wanted, all three of us. So it was their decision first, because I don't treat it as my company. I mean, I own it currently, but, you know, my aim at some point in the future is they can have all of it. You know, I don't sort of need it. But, you know, for the moment, it's better that I'm at the forefront of it in terms of my profile, but I want them to overtake me and them to become the sort of faces properly, because they do all the work, I don't.
Of course. In terms of profile, Paul, it's only been recently that you've kind of put yourself out there a little bit more. You've taken your Instagram off private. You started tweeting again about Birmingham City. You've done a few more podcast appearances, but you're not somebody that's always maybe chased the limelight by maybe showing all the things that you've been up to. Like our mutual acquaintance, Andy Smith, who made this podcast happen, he was laughing that if you don't know Paul Richardson, then you don't know. But when you do know, you really do know, like all the things that you've done. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, look, you know, back in my day before Gymshark, you know, it just wasn't a thing. You know, I was never really into social. I learned a massive amount from, you know, the Gymshark era and, you know, became more social. But when we sort of had Ben at the forefront of Gymshark, and in essence, Steve and I were sort of just behind him, and then there was all these brilliant, brilliant people sort of by our side and around us, doing all the hard work. You know, they didn't want myself and Steve, you know, the Gymshark fans didn't want two old boys. I mean, I'm older than Steve, so, and when he hears this, he'll probably chuckle. They didn't want two old boys at the forefront, so it was always Ben there that should be at the forefront. It was just nice when I stepped out of that sort of shadow from Ben's point of view. I wanted to show something different. You know, Ben is at the forefront of a hugely successful one-off brand. What I'd like to show for myself is I've done this several times, you know, from Waste Management a couple of times, All Saints. You know, I wasn't, you know, I didn't do All Saints. I had some really good partners in Nick Dunn and Stuart Trevor, and they did most of the work again. And then going to Birmingham City and then Birmingham City again, I wanted to show that, you know, if you're going to be an entrepreneur and call yourself that, which is probably slightly old-fashioned word today, but if you need to do things more than once, you know, a one-trick pony is fantastic, but, you know, to get that sort of breadth of experience and all the different things to have in your locker, you know, I mean, I can open my locker up and it's quite full. I can take things out and still be quite full in there. But that's what I wanted to show, that there's a person here that has a lot to offer, has had a lot of experience. And, you know, you can apply a lot of the things, but even with a bit old school today, you know, and I'm slightly opinionated on some things, you know, but that's just me. You know, I talk it like it is. I don't like to mince around with the words and sort of, you know, I like to get straight to the point.
I think I've got massive appreciation for that, and I'm very glad that I've been able to have the conversation with you as well, Paul. How much of that do you think links to legacy in terms of showing that you've done all these different things across the board, across so many different sectors? You've done it multiple times over. You're kind of you've ticked the box many, many times. You've been tested and succeeded. How much of that links to like a legacy that you want to leave behind us for the Richardson family?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things I talk about is, you know, being able to sort of bounce back and, you know, being able to sort of, you'll get problems come up all the time. So for me, I've had problems in waste management, in recycling, in all the different things I've ever done. And they're all very, very similar. You know, you sort of, you know, you get problems every day. You know, some are quite small. Some are real big problems, but every day you'll get problems. So resilience to me, you know, resilience through business is paramount. Like I've been through several recessions. I know we'll come out of this recession we're in or we're going in. You know, the sun goes up and the sun goes down and it still comes up and it still comes down. So everything just carries on. So sort of get that in your head and it's all not so bad. You know, you might be slightly different. You know, we went into the pandemic and we've come out of the pandemic. You know, we'll come through it. It might be slightly different when you come out of it, but you know you're going to come through it. And you know, and that I'm talking business-wise there, by the way. Some don't make it. You know, that, again, that's just life. If you're unfortunate to be in a sector or to be in something that, you know, doesn't quite make it, then you've got to learn from that and say, okay, fine. That was just really shit luck. You know, that was just that. What am I going to do now? You know, I've got to find something else. I'm going to move on. So, again, it can be huge that you bounce back from, something huge that was a problem. It can be a small thing, you know, it can be you got a puncture in your car this morning or, you know, someone cut you up in the lane or whatever, you know. Every day you get things. So for me, the thing I want to leave is that sort of resilience, ability to bounce back, get knocked down 9 times, get up at 10, all those sort of cliche things. That's one of the things that I look up with my daughters a lot, and, you know, show them that, you know, the businesses I've been through, some of them have been really, really tough. And then you have Gymshark, which was tough in a different way, but, you know, far easier than waste management. I can tell you that for nothing.
Perspective is a massive thing, isn't it? Like, I've been here and struggled with this, but I've come through it.
Yeah, and you do, you know, and you just have that positive mindset that it will be okay and you will be okay, and just keep your mind, your body really strong. I'm a massive believer in keeping yourself healthy. And, you know, Stephen Bartlett, I listen to quite a lot, and, you know, he's talked about it recently, that it's paramount, you know, your health, both, you know, physically and mentally, needs to be correct if you're going to be successful in any way, shape or form, because whether that's in business or whether an Olympian or whether you're an athlete or whatever it might be, you know, you need those things to work for you.
I was going to ask, what role does all your strength training and your focus on your health play in enabling you in your early 60s to continue to be so highly involved in so many different businesses?
I just think it's massive. I think, you know, I go in the gym and, you know, I never come out feeling sort of, I always feel better than when I come out. You know, I look after myself, and I want to continue to do that. You know, I haven't always, you know, in my life, I haven't always, you know, I very rarely drink these days and things like that. But I just think it's massive. I think the whole thing of, you know, physical and mental health is, you know, something that we need to pay good attention to. And the younger you start, the better it will be, because it becomes your lifestyle, and that's what it is. It isn't, you know, just something you do, it's your lifestyle. So a big believer in that, and that will transfer through to business. You know, obviously, if you're going to be a bodybuilder, for instance, you know, you don't just walk in there and then lift a few weights and suddenly become Jay Cutler or someone like that, or, you know, Ronnie Coleman, or whoever, the Chris Bumstead of today. It takes time, and it takes layers, and it takes work, and it takes effort, and it takes resilience. And that's the same with business. You're not going to just walk in and go, boom, right, I'm now, you know, a multi-billionaire. You know, it takes time, it takes hard work, it takes resilience.
I find it funny that we spoke about the importance of training at David Lloyd Bromsgrove in terms of your network and how you've ended up meeting these people. And it's actually a hack that one of my friends, Richard Dixon, he's a kind of property investor, millionaire, and he recommends that people spend that little bit extra on their gym membership to be around people that are potentially doing more interesting things. Because if you're willing to spend 90, 100, 110 pounds a month on a membership, you're probably willing to do other things in other areas of your life as well, whether it's invest in property, run businesses, be entrepreneurial. So you end up around those people. But I know that you've built up a pretty impressive home gym. How are you finding training in there versus maybe your more traditional gym environments?
Yeah, I like both. So I still got my membership at LC, and you know, it's great. I was there the weekend. I still train at home. I use both. But yeah, my gym at home is great, obviously, because I built LC, so I know what I'm doing. I'd like to spend a bit more time at home than I do, you know, again, but, you know, sometimes when you're training on your own, it's a little bit more difficult. Through the winter, it's probably a bit tougher than the summer, because I've got doors I can open, the sun will be shining. So yeah, I just want to do a bit more at home, to be fair. I get drawn back to LC because it's such a buzzy place. You know,
I was going to say, the atmosphere is amazing, and the people that you get to spend time around. And last but certainly not least, Paul, you're looking to get back involved with Birmingham City. I think it's quite publicly noted now that the club's been run very, very poorly. And while I'm not a Birmingham Blue, I'm a Glasgow Blue, I'm a Rangers fan, and I know the pain that can come through having owners that don't have maybe the club's best interests or are negligent when they are managing a football club. And it seems that the way that it's being run at the moment is making it very challenging for fans to feel that there's a way forward. And they maybe had that chink of light where they thought that in, what was it, December time, you pretty much paid a deposit to take over the club, and it was snatched away. What are the next moves that you can legally talk about for you and Birmingham City Football Club?
It's right. I mean, it's well documented at the moment with all the different clubs that I've had. I think it's very difficult to use the word foreign owners, because then you're sort of being a bit unfair to everyone. But owners that don't care as much as they should do, I think, and there's a lot of that in clubs. And I was with someone yesterday, actually, and I asked them why these sort of owners get involved in these clubs, because it's not the best business model, to be honest. It's just not a good business model. I mean, I do think there are some things that can be done within clubs to really help that, because, you know, what I've looked at so far, they've run sort of not run as well as they should be. So I think there's improvements to be made. I think from my point of view, the Birmingham City deal, I and myself and my consortium pulled out in November, end of November. We had a length of time in there, 4 months, which was much longer than we originally supposed to be in there. And, you know, we were paying for a lot of things that we didn't want to keep paying for. So we went to the point of the end of our long stop on our deal. And if we went, we now need to change some things. Unfortunately, the seller didn't want to change those things, so we were left with no alternative but to pull out. We are still around. We're still talking and we're still interested. There are several other clubs for sale at the moment. Sort of as we sort of pulled out of Birmingham City, I had a flood of emails and phone calls from various clubs to say, if you want to come and look at this. And there are some really, really good clubs out there that we're looking at. But my heart is obviously still with Birmingham, but it's a really difficult deal, And there's only probably, it's not even a handful of people that would take it on. And I'm probably one of those, because I'm a bit mad. I will do things unconventional, but I'll always try and see the good side to it. And I like a challenge as well. So
there's the whole connection piece as well. Like I mentioned Rangers in 2015, it was Rangers fans that took the club back and ran forward with it. And people grumble about certain decisions the board make, but they know it's in the hands of people that really do care about what happens on the field, what happens with our stadium, what happens with our history and our culture. And that gives the fans reassurance, even if maybe they appoint the wrong manager, or they don't back the manager in a transfer window in the way they want. That's inconsequential versus potential, not oblivion in the way that Rangers faced, but just falling down the leagues and becoming something that's not becoming of a football club that has premiership potential as it showed in the past.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, a football club is there for the fans. That's pure and simple. It's not there for the owners. The owners are just custodians for the length of time that they're there. And they need to have the thoughts of the fans at the very forefront of the mind. From my point of view, I know all the different factions of the Birmingham City fans. I know you can't please them all the time, and I would never ever believe, even if I was a multi-billionaire, that I could please them all the time. So I'm not that naive. I know that our consortium would have the fans at heart and the community. For me, that's the most important thing, first and foremost. We would have invited fans to be involved in the club. I would have wanted that, because I think it's really important. And that's all the different factors, not just the sort of older, you know, guys have been there many years, you know, the younger people, the various people that are involved, and also, you know, making sure you make the right decisions for the long term. But it's something that's at the heart of a community. It's really surprising, you know, what it means to those people. I've never forgot that, being involved really directly in some of the day-to-day, you know, from August to November. If we get the chance to do it, you know, we will do it. And it will be done right, and it will be run as a sustainable club. Any club that I'm involved with will have to be, I'll use the word sustainable, not from the ESG point of view, but from the point of view that it'll have to sort of wash its face or be able to afford its bills, etc. So that's where I am on it. And I think, but I do think there's another attitude can come to football, because it's got this stigma and it's got a lot of people in there that all they're into is making money out of it. And by the time it gets to the end, you know, something that costs £1 will cost you £5, because everyone's had a slice of it. All sorts of different ways, and that really has to stop, because it's not a money pit, you know, not everyone's got, I mean, you know, Sky and all that money will, sometime in the future, some people happen, and it will not be there or whatever. So you shouldn't base everything on things that
on the TV deals. Yeah,
on the TV deals or something that's going to change in the future. So you've got to cut your cloth accordingly. But we'll see what happens.
I completely agree, and I think from a football fan's perspective, I think you can see why all the fans are very keen for somebody like yourself and Maxi Lopez to be involved, because you speak in the right way, you speak from the heart, and you have the vested interest of the club beyond, like you say, just a quick profit or an ego project. Because while you say it was your dream job to sit on the board in 2002, 2004, it wasn't just done to massage your ego. It was done because you're like, oh, well, I've been asked to get involved and I can build this bridge between David Sullivan and the Karen Brady and the fans and move us forward in the right direction. In the same way, you can come at a time in its history where the club has become a little bit debased from where it should be.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we'll see where we go with it. You know, I'm still here. I'm not going anywhere. As I said, we are looking at other clubs, but yeah, it's a challenge. I like a challenge, though.
Yes, you certainly do, Paul, and you've explained how you've overcome many of them throughout this discussion, and I've thoroughly enjoyed the time with you. If people want to continue the conversation, where should they head towards to connect with you?
Yeah, I'm open now, as you said earlier, on Instagram. That's probably the easiest one to get me on. You know, I do look at them on a daily basis, and I don't reply to everyone, but if someone's got something genuine, you know, I'll try and get back to them when I can. And I like to help people where I can. But if there's any questions, yeah, just fire them over on there.
Fantastic, Paul. What a pleasure. And thank you very much to you, the listener, for joining us. And I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very